From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peter Brook has been internationally acclaimed for his theater and film productions of Marat Saad, King Lear, and Carmen. His 9-hour stage version of the sacred Indian text, the Mahabharata, was one of the biggest theater events of the 80s. On today's Fresh Air, Brook tells us how he adapted that epic production into a film. Also, we meet John Glover. He's starring in Gremlins 2 as the powerful Trump-like developer. Rock historian Ed Ward recently visited Hawaii, and he brought back some music for us. And TV critic David Bianculli phones in from L.A., where he's previewing the fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that he'll nominate Appeals Court Judge David Souter to a seat on the Supreme Court. If he's confirmed by the Senate, Judge Souter, who's 50, will succeed retiring Justice William Brennan. President Bush has insisted throughout that he was looking for someone who shares his general philosophy but would not apply any specific ideological tests, especially on the critical issue of abortion. At his news conference today, the president reasserted that he was looking for a judge who will interpret the law in the most limited sense.
Judge Souter committed to interpreting, not making the law. He recognizes the proper role of judges in upholding the democratic choices of the people through their elected representatives with constitutional constraints.
President Bush also had high praise for Justice Brennan, the court's leading liberal, as one of the greatest figures of his age. The launch of an Atlas rocket from Cape Canaveral this afternoon has been delayed once again. Electrical problems have forced NASA to postpone the launch at least 24 hours. Dave Pignanelli reports.
The Atlas 1 was scheduled to lift off at 3:26 Eastern Time, but when controllers sent a command for the rocket to switch to internal power, the Atlas failed to respond. The problem meant that the first launch window of the day would be missed, but officials could try again in about an hour. The electrical problem, however, proved too difficult to fix in such a short time, so the launch attempt was called off altogether. This was the third postponement of what is to be General Dynamics' first attempt at the commercial space launch business. A helium leak called off last Friday's attempt. Bad weather postponed the launch for a second time over the weekend. The Atlas is to carry a radiation-observing satellite into orbit for the United States government. NASA is acting as a launch manager for the company. Officials will now continue to troubleshoot the problem in hopes of trying to launch the vehicle again, possibly as early as tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
For the second time, a jury in the McMartin preschool child molestation trial may be deadlocked. NPR's Celeste Wesson reports from Los Angeles.
The first trial in the McMartin case turned into the longest and most expensive criminal trial ever. That jury cleared preschool teacher Peggy McMartin Buckey and her son Raymond Buckey of 52 charges and deadlocked on the rest. Now, after a much smaller and faster trial, another jury is having trouble too. They've returned two sealed verdicts, but they've told the judge they've been unable to reach a decision on the other six counts. The judge is meeting this afternoon with lawyers from both sides before he decides whether to accept a hung jury or urge the jurors to resume their deliberations. I'm Celeste Wesson in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street today, prices posted their third biggest loss of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 56 points to close at 2,904.7. Declines led advances 7-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In theater circles, he is a guru, regarded with an awe that borders on the religious. That's how my guest Peter Brook was once described in The Atlantic magazine. Peter Brook is a former director of the Royal Shakespeare Company in London. He adapted several of his most acclaimed theater productions for the screen, including Marat Saad, King Lear, and Carmen. He also directed the films Meetings with Remarkable Men and the 1963 version of The Lord of the Flies. For over a decade, Brook has been absorbed in bringing the Mahabharata to the stage and screen. The Mahabharata is a sacred Indian text written in Sanskrit. It's over 200 years old and over 10 times the length of the Bible. It's part myth, part history, part religious text, telling the story of the creation of mankind. The theater version was 9 hours long. I spoke with Brook when the 3-hour film adaptation opened in New York last April. It's now playing in Boston and Los Angeles. Peter Brook told me how we first encountered the Mahabharata.
I was doing a show in London about this country called US, which was about the Vietnam War. And we called it US Us because it was about the relation between the English and the Americans and Vietnam. And we were all very concerned at that time. And one day, a young Indian came into rehearsal and dropped into my hands a tiny play he had written. And I looked at it, and it was just about one incident. I didn't even know at the time that he came from the Mahabharata, which was about a great general who, just as he's about to give the signal to launch a battle that could lead to the extermination of all mankind, stopping in his tracks and asking himself this great question, why should we fight? And we wanted to incorporate it in our show, and we couldn't. But this powerful image remained with me. And then gradually over the years, I learned, first of all, that this was the center of the great sacred book of India called the Bhagavad Gita. And then Jean-Claude Carrière, the writer who was working with me in Paris, and I learned from a great French Sanskrit scholar that the Bhagavad Gita, in its turn, is just the culminating point in an enormous epic poem called the Mahabharata.
Did you ever end up going back to the text itself and reading it in English translation?
Oh, of course. So after this, Jean-Claude Carrière, we were both very excited by this, and he was fired to write a play, and he wrote a short play entirely based on what we'd heard. We looked at it and then realized that this was just a sketch. We had to go into it more seriously, and then began many years of work where we sat together and read through the entire 18 volumes in English translation, the same in an incomplete 19th century French translation, and then read many different shortened versions, went to India, compared versions, talked to scholars, talked to people in the street, listened to storytellers, and gradually, in that way, got sufficiently drenched in the material for Jean-Claude 10 years later to begin to write the full script. And we made one vow. We said we're not going to fix a time limit, either on the time it will take to write it or the time that the show should take. We will let it find its natural shape. And its natural shape was 9 hours, and its natural divisions were in 3 parts.
Yeah, the theatrical version was 9 hours. I mean, a theatrical production of that length has certain advantages in the sense that you clear away everything else from your life to go see this because you have to create a whole day. It becomes an event, a kind of holiday from life to immerse yourself in this theatrical event. On the other hand, there's certain disadvantages. First of all, who has the time to do that? And it takes a certain physical stamina to spend most of the day sitting in one chair. In a theater, what were your considerations about producing something of that length, both in terms of what it would take out of the actors and what it would require from the audience?
I didn't give a thought to either of those. I only thought of one thing, which is that the Mahabharata is a great and important work, and suddenly we're in the privileged position of being able to bring it to people who don't know anything about it, after which Darwin's laws of natural selection operate, that in each city where we played it, it was always crammed to the roofs by natural selection. In other words, there were people, and I would be one of them. I think if I'd been just a member of the public, would say, oh my God, I can't go to the theatre and sit there for 9 hours. I wouldn't have gone to see that if I hadn't been connected with it. And many people followed the line of thinking you've just brought up and said, we won't go. But luckily, there were other people who said, this interests us, this attracts us, we are going to make the effort. And always, when you make an effort, you're rewarded.
Theater and film director Peter Brook is my guest, and his theatrical production of the Mahabharata has been adapted into a new film version. This isn't the first time you've brought one of your theater productions to film. No. Can you discuss some of your considerations when you're adapting something you've already done on stage? You don't want to just film the stage production.
No. I mean, the first thing is to realize that it's a completely different medium. It's a different language. And I've always enjoyed it. I've always found it a very, very fascinating technical challenge. In a way, if you're taking a subject and starting from zero, which I've done in other films, you construct the whole film in a quite different way. If you're starting from something that has already had existence in the theatre, first of all, you have a great leap ahead because you've got something that's been well prepared. The actors are well prepared. Lots of the scenes have been really worked over and brought into their best form. So there is a good starting point. On the other hand, it is in theatre form. So what's one trying to do? Now, when I made the film of the Mahabharata, of the Marasad, the aim was to see how one could put onto the screen the sensation of being in the audience, not what it would be like to stick a camera in the stalls, because if you stuck a camera in the stalls, you wouldn't get the sensation of being in the audience. You'd just see a flat picture, which would give you everything except that sensation. So here we had to use highly cinematic devices with a camera constantly on the move and a very complex cutting structure to give the physical sensation of being part of that performance. Now, the Mahabharata is slightly different because the Mahabharata is a narrative. And what I wanted to do was to, I chose to do it in a studio rather than on real locations, to be able to capture something that goes right back to the origins of the cinema, which is that particular thing that only a film studio can give as a dream factory, a form of cinema such as, what can I say, there have been many studio films going right back, say, to The Wizard of Oz, that are not realistic, and at the same time are not theatre. They're part of that particular great magic of the cinema which belongs to studio. And that was the basis on which we made the Mahabharata film.
Now, your movie, The Mahabharata, is 3 hours, whereas the stage production was 9 hours. Is the scaling down in time economical, or does it have to do with the differences between theatre and film?
There are two versions. There is a television version of 6 hours, which is going to be aired, I think, in a year's time, mm-hmm. and which has been shown already all over the world, and specifically film version. The 6 hours is exactly the same, really, as the 9 hours, surprisingly. There you see the difference between theatre speed and film speed, that exactly the same scenes, just because you're in closer with the actors don't have to walk in and walk off. The fact that you can cut right into the middle of a phrase in the cinema, and the fact that because you're in big close-up, everything can be done with less force, and consequently it all goes quicker, means that you can lose a couple of hours without even cutting a line. And with little trimming, we got 9 hours down to 6 hours with no problem. Then came the other challenge, which was to make a purely cinematic film. And here the approach was different. It was no longer trying, as in the full version, to tell the whole story. It was to give a very, very intense impression of what the Mahabharata is. So I'd compare it much more with finding yourself in the center of a maze or of one of those hall of mirrors in funfairs, where you see an extraordinary amount of strange images leaving you in different directions. And the aim is not to spell everything out. The aim is to give you a quite bewildering, kaleidoscopic, but very intense impression of what this great, almost unknown, many-leveled work from several thousand years ago called the Mahabharata is.
There's a lot of talk today about multiculturalism and multiculturalism in the arts. Back in 1968, you formed an international theater group in Paris, which you still had, the International Center of Theater Research.
Yes.
And you've been working with actors from around the world. I think 36 countries are represented in the cast of your new movie. What was it you wanted to learn by creating such an international cast to work with?
Something very simple. I feel that all of us, every human being, is incomplete. And the world's tragedies come from the moments when we think that we are complete and everybody else is incomplete. But the moment we realize that we're all unfinished bits in a giant jigsaw, we can see that there is something infinitely precious that we can gain if we can make a living and working relationship with people very different from ourselves. if we're with people who are very much like ourselves and we have the same beliefs, the same ideas, we become a clan and eventually an arrogant clan that really does believe that it's complete. If we're with people who in every way are different but whom we can respect because we see that they are human beings like ourselves, but they have different possibilities, a different understanding, their strengths are different from ours, their weaknesses are different from ours, then through a very hard, specific program, which is of working together, not just sitting loving one another and making universal brotherhoods, but hard, practical work for a purpose, which is, say, producing a play so that people can actually pay money to go and see it. When you have that to bind you together, gradually these incomplete bits open up and something is shared by everyone, and each person is enriched by the experience, and so is the result.
Let's talk practically for a minute, though, when you have people from different countries who represent different languages, who will have different accents when they speak English, who, because of their skin tones, are obviously from different cultures and different parts of the world. Can you create a naturalistic play where everybody's of the same family or everybody's from the same background? Do you know what I mean? If that's required of the text.
I think that this is the real and extraordinary miracle that the theatre can achieve. That ever, all through history, when acting has been powerful enough, it can sell anything to an audience, and the audience is delighted to buy it. The simplest example is that many old actresses, and particularly one reads Sarah Bernhardt when she was old and had and limped, still managed to convey to an audience that she was a young girl or that she was a young man by the power of her acting. And the moment that you sweep away this very, very false notion that has only recently crept into the theatre, that the theatre should be like a photograph of everyday life, and you realize that theatre is a platform or a space in which an actor is like a storyteller, conjuring up something for the imagination of the audience, you can see that an old man can play a young girl, that a black man can play a young white man, or a Japanese can play an English hero, that these all depend on the power of the talent and the conviction of the actors. When this succeeds, the audience is touched in a new way.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your work in stage and film. And my guest is director Peter Brook. This is Fresh Air. Theater and film director Peter Brook is my guest. His films include the 1963 version of Lord of the Flies, Meetings with Remarkable Men, and the screen adaptations of his theater productions of King Lear and Marat Sade. His new film, The Mahabharata, is adapted from his 9-hour play, which dramatized the sacred Indian text, The Mahabharata. When you got out of college, you wanted to make movies. You wanted to direct, but you ended up directing theater first instead of film. Why did you want to do film over theater, but why did you end up actually starting in theater?
I've always liked films. I mean, it's been my first great passion along with photography, and it never occurred to me for a moment that I'd work in the theater. I've made a film when I was at college, when I was, I think, 18 or 19, and then went into films, and I worked in films as various sorts of assistant, but all I wanted to do was to make my own film. And I went from one producer to another, but particularly in those days, nobody would dream of giving a 19, 20-year-old young man a film to direct. And I was impatient, very impatient. And I turned to the theatre as a sort of quick, cheap substitute. And even there it wasn't easy because the big theatres said exactly the same thing. They said, come back another day, come back when you've done something somewhere else, until in the end I found a theatre so tiny where the production cost was so low that they really took no risk at all in letting an unknown young man do a play there. And from then onwards, that has really been the balance. I mean, I have, in the course of it, got as interested, as passionately involved as in the theatre as in the cinema, but what has made it possible for me to do about 60 productions in the theatre and make 10 films is that, as I've never wanted to do a commercial film and I've always wanted to do just the subjects that interested me, as in the theatre I can get, could always get, a project going in a few weeks, and the same sort of project in the cinema would take a few years.
So you never wanted to make conventional movies? You never wanted to do a Western or a detective story or
no.
a comedy?
No, I
romance.
Love going to see them. Uh-huh. In fact, I've never wanted to do what I've seen other people do well.
You thought you had something else that was your calling?
Yes, so that when I've seen a Western, I mean, I've seen marvelous Westerns, and having seen, say, John Ford make a Western, the last thing I want to do is to go into rivalry with him. I'd rather go and see one of his films once again and do something quite different.
You've directed many actors during your career. You once wrote about directing John Gielgud, and you said, you know, Gielgud is a great actor. He has so many ideas. In a way, he has too many ideas, and that your job as a director became focusing those ideas, limiting those ideas. What are some of the other things what is the flexibility of in your role of director, depending on who it is that you are directing? I mean, do you have to become a different kind of director depending on who the actor is?
You know, there's a director really has got two possibilities, and both of them are equally strong. One of them is intervening, and the other is listening. And if you intervene all the time and don't listen and watch sufficiently, then you become the sort of director that one doesn't really admire, which is a director who is all the time imposing himself and who's using other people as a way of imposing his ideas. If, on the other hand, you are too passive and you watch and you listen and you're too gentle and too broad-minded and you fail to intervene when intervention is desperately needed, you become a weak director. So there isn't a rule. One spends all one's time between those two possibilities, depending on the actor. Some actors you have to intervene occasionally. Some you have to intervene tactfully. Sometimes, very rarely, you have to intervene very drastically, forcefully, and even brutally. But those are extreme measures that you really want to avoid. And most of the time, you're in between all of those things, listening to the actor, watching how he's developing, seeing where he is going right and righter than you ever expected. And so all you need to do there is to encourage him, or where you see him, without knowing it, beginning to slip away from what he himself wants to do. And there you can help him recover.
We've mentioned theater and film. You've also directed a lot of operas, but I think you kind of left opera.
Yeah.
A while ago.
Slamming the door.
Yeah, why?
I left opera for something like 25 years until we did Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was very simple. I realized that in the conditions of big opera houses, it was impossible to do really good work because there's a system. And a system is like a political system. It's like a system that's been in Eastern Europe, that if you had a choice between becoming a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe or going your own way in the West, I think that very few people would deliberately choose to become a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe. And exactly the same way, if you have a free choice between directing in sympathetic, good, quiet conditions with actors who are interested, who have egos but are not dominated by them and who really wish to share their work to make a good result, or to go into the opera house where you have impossibly short rehearsals, union clashes all the time, hysterical, over-important, ego-devoured singers, unwilling to rehearse, greedy because they can get more money by rushing from one part of the world to another with a minimum of rehearsal, doing the maximum of high-powered, of highly overpriced performances, you realize that you must be mad to prefer to work in those rotten conditions than to work with them. On the other hand, opera is a great form, and singers can be marvelous people. So I made a very simple vow. I would never work in a great opera house, but I would do an opera the moment it was possible to bring together a group of really dedicated young singers and musicians within our own theater, where we have none of these horrifying structural blocks that almost every big institution is bound to suffer from, whether it wants to do so or not.
When you were at Oxford University, you founded the Film Society there. What did you do in it?
First of all, we showed films. We showed great silent films that people had heard about, you know, the great Russian films and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and the Dreyer films and Murnau films that we knew about as legendary pictures, but we had no other way of seeing. And then we made a film. We made a film called A Sentimental Journey from Lawrence Stern's book, which we shot in the middle of war with incredible difficulty, with the only film we could find, which was rejected camera gun film that the RAF didn't use, so they just sold a sort of bulk lots of sort of largely dud negative. And in wartime, it was forbidden to use any laboratory for amateur work. So I found a little man in London who was illegally making pornographic films. And so to do this, he had to have his own laboratory because he couldn't send his films to anyone else to process. And I came to an arrangement with him to develop our films for us. And it was in those sort of conditions we made our first film.
That's interesting. Did you ever watch his movies?
No, but he was a very sweet man, and he kept saying to me, one of these days I must show you. He'd look at our film, and he said, that's very good. I'm sure that one of my films you would enjoy most of all, which was called Wood Nymph, and this became a legend. He'd always say to me, well, Mr. Brooke, he said, one of these days I'll show you Wood Nymph, but I'm afraid he never did.
I have one last question for you. What's your prescription for a healthy theatre?
To stop thinking that the theatre can be even discussed in these broad generalizations.
Uh-huh.
Each single act of theater is a new event, and what's healthy is to make the most of that event without ever imagining that the theater as a whole is going to get better or going to get worse or change its direction, because the theater as a whole is always going to be an extraordinary mixture, a great hodgepodge in which each person can only take responsibility for his little corner of it and cultivate his own field as best he can.
Theatre and film director Peter Brook. His film adaptation of the Mahabharata is now showing in Boston and Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the X rating comes under fire as film directors petition for an A for adult classification. We'll hear from Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, Russell Schwartz of Miramax, an independent film company that has four films that were rated X this year, and film director Wayne Wang, whose new film just received an X. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A recent trip to Hawaii inspired our rock historian Ed Ward to present a capsule history of Hawaiian music and to let us know there's more to Hawaiian music than the corny kitsch you may be accustomed to. Also, playing opposite Gremlins with actor John Glover. In Gremlins 2, he plays a developer and TV mogul whose empire becomes invaded by the slimy, obnoxious creatures. And TV critic David Bianculli says the success of Fox has the other networks scrambling. He reports to us from Los Angeles, where he's previewing the fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Only 3 days after Justice William Brennan announced that he is leaving the U.S. Supreme Court, President Bush has announced that he is nominating Appeals Court Judge David Souter to the High Court. 3 months ago, Judge Souter was named to the First Circuit Court of Appeals by Mr. Bush. Before that, he was appointed to the State Supreme Court of New Hampshire by then-Governor John Sununu, who is now the President's Chief of Staff. In announcing his nomination today, the president said that he had not questioned Souter's views on controversial topics such as abortion.
You might think the whole nomination had something to do with abortion, and it's far broader than that. I have too much respect for the Supreme Court than to look at one specific issue and one alone.
In meeting reporters today at the White House, Judge Souter also declined to answer questions in detail.
If it were possible for me to express to you the realization that I have of the honor which the President has just done me, I would try and I would keep you here as long tonight as I had to do to get it out. But I could not express that realization, and I'm not going to try to do the impossible.
The Souter nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court will now go to the U.S. Senate for consideration there. Talks continue today between the leaders of Egypt and Iraq in an effort to end the oil dispute between Iraq and its Gulf neighbors, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. Egypt assumed the role of mediator after the Arab League had reached an impasse in its efforts to patch up differences. Larry James reports from Cairo.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak insisted today the crisis between Iraq and its Gulf neighbors could be easily resolved and predicted what he called a quiet and comfortable solution. But while the Egyptian leader was criticizing the media attention around the crisis, Iraq's official press escalated its attack, calling Kuwait's foreign minister an agent of the United States in what Baghdad termed an American plot to destroy Iraq's economy. Kuwaiti head of state Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah phoned Egyptian President Mubarak today in what Cairo said was an effort to contain the crisis. The dispute erupted last week when Baghdad charged Kuwait and the UAE with trying to sabotage Iraq's economy by driving oil prices lower through overproduction. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
Three more people trying to leave Cuba have now sought refuge in the Swiss embassy in Havana. It's believed that some 24 people are now located in foreign embassies in Havana in their efforts to get out of the country. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 56 points after being down over 100 points in earlier trading. The Dow Jones Industrials closed at 2,904.7 on volume of some 209 million shares. Declining issues led advances 7-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, a conversation with one of the stars of Gremlins 2, John Glover. But first, rock and roll historian Ed Ward recently went to Hawaii to explore the music scene there. He's returned with some great music and an appreciation of its roots.
I've I've probably never faced such a difficult task in my life as an enthusiast of weird music as I have recently, trying to convince people that Hawaiian music is worth listening to. Right now, it's hanging on in Hawaii by a fingernail, still in danger of extinction, in the face of Vegas shows and the omnipresent Japanese laserdisc karaoke sing-along phenomenon. But after visiting Hawaii in May and talking to representatives of several generations of Hawaiian musicians, I'm more enthusiastic about it than ever. The earliest Hawaiian music was just like the percussion we heard at the beginning of that modern arrangement of an old chant, kavika. Since the point of the chant was to accompany the hula, melody took a secondary position. But when the missionaries introduced melody with their hymns, or himeni as the Hawaiians called them, the Hawaiians went for it wholeheartedly. The song we just heard, Alika, shows a number of facets of down-home Hawaiian music. A swing-influenced instrumental track, a vocal by a woman imitating a man singing falsetto in the himeni tradition, and a steel guitar. The Hawaiian steel guitar was supposedly invented by a young man named Joseph Kekuku, who was 11 years old the day he accidentally slid a bolt across the strings of his guitar and heard the future of Hawaiian music. You can take that story for the truth, or agree with steel guitar virtuoso Bob Brosman that man has a natural inclination to slide. But the fact was, the steel soon became a signature sound in Hawaiian music. After the 1915 Pan Pacific Exhibition in San Francisco, Hawaii mania rampaged across the United States, and no vaudeville show was complete without a steel guitar and some hula girls. Saul Hoopy, whom we just heard playing Lady Be Good, was probably the top player on the instrument and inspired plenty of people to pick the instrument up. Hawaiian orchestras were so popular down south that country musicians started to incorporate steel guitar into hillbilly bands, and soon such notable players as Jerry Bird were pulling down huge salaries in Nashville. Bird had been inspired by Hawaiians, and he's most famous for recording with Hank Williams, but today he lives and teaches steel guitar in Honolulu. Meanwhile, the 30s saw the coming of a radio program called Hawaii Calls, which lasted until the 70s and promulgated most of the syrupy, sentimental music most people associate with the words Hawaiian music. Meanwhile, the older singers and songwriters kept the less commercial music alive in their homes, at their luaus, and in funky clubs and bars. Probably the most enduring and least commercialized form of Hawaiian music is slack key guitar, a very lazy, informal kind of guitar picking that's been around since the Portuguese introduced steel strings for guitars in the 1860s. Probably the greatest slack key guitarist ever to record was Gabby Pahanui, who died in 1980 at the age of 59. His records inspired Ry Cooter to hunt him down and then to bring a state-of-the-art recording setup to a remote location in Kona to record him jamming with Gabby. Cooter also tried to get him to tour with him, but Pahanui refused. Gabby's son Cyril was part of the Sunday Manoa, a band whose 1969 album Guava Jam redefined Hawaiian music in a contemporary context. Sunday Manoa, in turn, spawned the Peter Moon Band, who are still a big local attraction, and inspired a whole new generation of Hawaiian musicians who are managing to hold on despite a lack of places to play and the prejudice of audiences who can only think of tiny bubbles when they think of Hawaiian music. Slack key guitarist Raymond Kane and singer Ledward Kaapana are touring this summer, and if your vacation plans take you to Honolulu anytime soon, I hope you'll take a moment out to look for some of the genuine music of that far corner of America, Hawaii.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie Gremlins 2, John Glover plays Daniel Clamp. The character is a cross between media mogul Ted Turner and developer Donald Trump. The character displays more ego than evil, which is unlike some of the roles that Glover is best known for. He's played a series of sleazy villains in such films as 52 Pickup, Masquerade, and Scrooged. Gremlins 2 is directed by Joe Dante, who also directed the first Gremlins movie. Steven Spielberg is the executive producer. In the film, Glover is attacked by one of the gremlins that have taken over his headquarters. Glover gets rid of the gremlin by stuffing it in a paper shredder. I asked him to describe what it was like working so closely with gremlins.
There were different stages depending upon how close the camera got to us. If it was close enough, then the gremlin was operated by about five different people so that... It was quite amazing and like working with an incredibly talented actor. But if the camera was far away, I had to operate it myself, and they rigged up this fake arm on my suit, and I put my hand up into the gremlin, and they taped my upper arm, down to me, and I had to make it attack me, which was incredibly difficult because I kept doing what my hand was doing. So it was both. It was some of the hardest work I've ever had to do when I had to manipulate the puppet myself and be me.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the easiest acting, too, when the five people were manning this thing, because it was so like a real living thing. Quite horrifying. In between takes, the guy would keep his hand in it and keep it alive, and it became this little cuddly thing. That seemed about like my dog. It was so friendly and wonderful. And then Joe would yell action, and it would turn on me. So it was quite a schizophrenic day.
Did you want to visually suggest Donald Trump in your role?
No, I didn't think it was necessary. It was so obvious, I thought, that who we were parodying, that I didn't worry about mimicking or creating anything. But it is pretty obvious. Although when we were making the movie, I wasn't allowed to say Trump or Turner.
You weren't allowed to say it to who?
Anybody, if I talked to the press or anything.
Oh, this is to prevent any lawsuits.
I guess. But it was very secretive when we were doing the movie. You know, all the scripts were numbered, so each page of the script had a number stamped across it, and I guess the Spielberg office knew which person had what number, and for a long time the movie was called Monolith, so people wouldn't know what we were doing, and I don't quite know why all that was done, but we were sworn to secrecy. I was told at one point if any word leaked out, that whoever was caught would have to go in and eat their script in front of Steven Spielberg.
A strange form of punishment. In 52 Pickup, which was adapted from an Elmore Leonard novel and directed by John Frankenheimer, you played a pornographer and blackmailer.
Yeah.
And the first scene that you're in, we don't really see your face because you're wearing a ski mask, and you're blackmailing Roy Scheider with a film that you made of him with his mistress. And you're narrating the film, so we hear your voice before we see your face.
Where's Cindy? No talking during the show. You've seen some of this before, Mitch. Stuff your girlfriend shot. Las Palmas Hotel, Palm Springs, August 17 through 21st, while your wife thought you were in a convention in Miami. You rascal. Now here you are shooting abroad. Nice little body.
Your voice is very distinctive in that movie, and I was wondering if you were cast as much for your voice as you were for the rest of you as an actor.
I never knew why I was cast in that. I decided when I was working on 52 Pickup to use my Baltimore accent because I thought it would make the man more dangerous because it's such an inane sound. Not everybody. I don't want people from Baltimore to think, oh, dear. But I spoke in such a way to make him more dangerous because it had a kind of a certain insane sound to it, I thought, or a flatness, or, well, you know, it talks like that. You know. So, but it is a very distinct sound.
When you were growing up in Baltimore, did you actually have the kind of accent that you use in the movie?
Well, actually, I'm from a smaller town in Maryland, Salisbury, Maryland, that even has a worse kind of an accent. Or, see, there I go, putting a connotation on it.
Ever the diplomat.
Yes. I went to school in Baltimore. It took me a long time to lose that sound with those kind of flat O's and those things like that. And, you know, look at the baby. And an intonation that sort of sounds like that and an A sound. I remember I would talk about something that was sad, but it would be sad. Said that people couldn't understand what I was speaking of. So I worked very hard when I moved away to lose the accent, and since I've been using it. I used it in An Early Frost, which was quite wonderful and gave the man that I played a kind of vulnerability, and then in 52 Pickup, the accent gave the man a danger, I felt. And then they created a role for me on Molly Dodd, Jay Tarsus, who comes from Baltimore. Blair Brown's a good friend of mine, and I used to sit in restaurants with Jay and Blair, and Jay and I would goof off on that kind of funny Baltimore accent. So he created me a part on Molly Dodd that I'm about to go to New York in a couple of weeks and do again, another episode.
In the roles where you do play basically kind of perverted, violent character.
I beg your pardon.
Is there anything from your past that you feel you could draw on? I mean, where do you, what do you look to inside for those roles?
You're getting very personal now. Well, I have a very vivid imagination. How's that for a coy answer? I try and see these people, I think the badder or the more evil they are, the more frightened they are. I have a little dog, Annie, who's very aggressive when she sees strangers, when someone comes to the door or when she's out and she's surprised by someone. She'll attack. She never bites, but she'll run up to them and jump up on them and bark fiercely. And I understand that what it's about is her fear. So I see that those people that are so aggressive, and aggressive in an evil way to hurt people, I think it all comes out of very grand insecurities.
What made you want to go into acting?
You know, when I was in high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. My friends seemed to have made decisions about, you know, all those future this is and future that's, those clubs. I never had a future anything. I never knew what I wanted. And when I was a junior, there were auditions for the junior class play, which was Lilium. And I did go and auditioned. We all auditioned in the cafeteria, and we sat at tables, mobs of people, and I very timidly rose my hand and read one short scene, and I thought I read it very well, but I was totally overlooked and not cast. But I was on the stage crew, and I was chosen to carry furniture and props on and off very quickly between the scenes in a blue light, and we were told to wear black, a black turtleneck and black pants. And I had a derby hat of my dad's that I also chose to wear. And when I changed the scenery, I did something that was funny, and I started getting laughs. And the play only ran for 3 nights, but by the end of the third night, I was getting incredible laughs from just changing the scenery. And the drama teacher wasn't, I thought she'd be very angry at me, but she wasn't. And the next year I got the lead in the senior class play. And I found this kind of joy from being up on a stage and having people laugh at me. There was a kind of power and an acceptance, and I felt like I'd found my F club.
So it was really comedy that first got you started.
Yeah.
Sense of getting laughs. The last time I saw Annie Hall was a few years ago. I was looking at your resume, and you were in it. What part did you play?
I'm Touch My Heart With Your Foot. For real Annie Hallers, that they know what that means. I'm one of her old boyfriends, and we're at a party, and I'm being very intense, telling how I want to be torn apart by wild animals. And then I ask her to touch my heart with her foot.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Glover plays mogul Daniel Clamp in the new movie Gremlins 2. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you doing a follow-up on the resignation of Supreme Court Justice Brennan?
Yes, we'll hear about what they're saying on Capitol Hill today as senators prepare for what could be another bruising battle over a nomination to the Supreme Court, and most of them there hope will not be. A report from Cokie Roberts. We'll also be talking with Professor Walter Dellinger of Duke University about some of the background to Senate debates and battles over Supreme Court nominees and how at one time they became less contentious than they were before, and perhaps might become less contentious this time around. Also, we'll be hearing a talk with writer Eudora Welty and a report from Howard Berkus on new ways of teaching about the Old West.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is in Los Angeles getting the scoop on the new season. He's beginning the final week of a 3-week annual TV critic press tour. It's a grueling task, but somebody's got to do it. We've got David on the line from his hotel room. Hi, David.
Hi, it is grueling. Don't make fun of me. I want to get out of here.
Well, let's see what's in store for us. What's the network reaction been to the popularity of cable and of Fox? Can you see them reacting in the new season?
Oh, yeah, they're really running scared now. Not only are they programming more things, but they're actually counter-programming cable and Fox. The biggest indication is that standards are loosening at the networks this year, which I would normally applaud because in adult shows that's fine, but they're doing it in what was once the family hour time. And it's kind of awkward, but I've seen shows this time on CBS that'll be showing at 8 o'clock on the East Coast. I mean, the first words out of a kid's mouth is something that I can't even repeat to you on the radio, and it's going to be in prime time. So parents ought to really be advised, don't sample a new show with your young children unless you've seen it first, because they really are changing the rules somewhat. ABC doesn't seem to be so far.
So you think this is a response in part to programs like Married with Children?
Yes, definitely. And what's going to happen is this will be, like last year was too bland. Everything was so bland because they didn't want to alienate audiences, and the audiences went away anyway. So this year, they're trying to do strange stuff to bring them back, but that won't work either.
Well, let me ask you, is what they're doing basically just lots and lots of double entendres?
Yes.
Which will pose as being really adventurous.
Yes, exactly. And the whole idea of things that wouldn't be funny if they came out of the mouths of adults are supposed to be funny purely because they're coming out of the mouths of babes.
It seems ironic that the networks are becoming more liberal in terms of their language standards at a time when there's been so much controversy surrounding language and attempts at censorship.
Right. Well, TV's ahead of the curve in this respect because they got attacked by Terry Ricolta and by all of these pressure groups a couple of years ago. And Married with Children was the direct target. And what everybody found out is that they didn't have any impact at all. And Married with Children's ratings actually went up after the controversy. So while the rest of America is now sort of acting afraid in their own little arenas, TV's already weathered the storm, and so they're just sort of forging ahead.
What's the future of Twin Peaks?
Well, if you're waiting for, as most of us are, for Who Killed Laura Palmer, you got to wait and wait and wait. We had a Twin Peaks breakfast party out here yesterday, probably the highlight of my stay, where you got donuts and damn good coffee. And we got to find out that Laura Palmer's killer probably won't be revealed first week, second week, third week. It'll be somewhere between, I think, the third week and the 13th week of the season. And we won't even find out who shot Cooper in the first week. But there is a brand new special that they're doing on the last Saturday in September, the night before the Sunday two-hour premiere, which is like a Twin Peaks collector's item hour with all sorts of strange new stuff.
So what do you think is going to be the big hit of the season, David?
Probably The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which is coming out of NBC. It's got a real good time slot, and it's got Will Smith, who is part of that, the rap group that's, I don't think any part of America is going to find offensive, and the show is cute enough, and it'll probably go. NBC's given it a huge push.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thanks. Now just send me home.
Yes, you got to go back and watch more TV, right?
Yeah.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post, and he spoke to us from Los Angeles. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the debate over the X rating and the movie classification system. We'll talk to Jack Valenti, head of the Motion Picture Association of America, Wayne Wang, whose new film received an X rating, and Russell Schwartz of Miramax Films, which is distributing Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.